Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday. It is the 12th of September. Thank you very much for being with us, and we are always happy to have you in our company, and we so appreciate you taking the time out of your day to listen to us. I will tell you in just a moment who is on this program and who will make up the panel today. We have a lot to discuss, a lot of debate fallout. A couple of days ago, I was talking to JP in the hall. I think it was Tuesday, and I said to JP, "Are you on Wednesday show?" And he said, "No, I'm on Thursday show." And I said, "Oh, that's okay. We'll still get to talk about the debate." So we're in. Yes, we got it.
I'm really happy to be here.
Yeah, that's really
good.
I've
watched it 10 times.
Have you really?
No, just once.
I ended up watching it sort of again, like not all the way through, but a lot of it, because they ran it again on CNN. But yeah, it's interesting. It's much better when you know how it's going to end.
You guys have a high threshold for pain.
You also, like in a movie, you pick up other stuff.
You do.
The second time.
Oh, you do. No, absolutely. And you watch things, and then there's things that people have been talking about that you didn't hear. And no, absolutely. J.P. Miller is here from the Empire Report. Ira Fussfeld joins us, publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman. Hello, Ira.
Joe and everybody, good to see you. Happy to be here.
Good to have you here. And the star of the week, Nick Rangel, is here, executive director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, a panelist on our special Lockbox program that we did on Tuesday night. You were brilliant, and thanks again to that entire crew, but thank you for giving up your night, and most of all for coming back.
Yes, I know.
Twice in a week.
It is twice in a week. It's twice next week, too, right?
That's right. Yeah, I want to talk about that in a second, yes.
Yeah, and thanks so much. I just really love public radio, and I'm really happy to support the work everyone here does every single day.
Well, we thank you very much. I was singing your praises yesterday, saying how lucky we are to have you. And
I do listen to the roundtable in between my appearances. I caught that. Thanks, Joe.
You're welcome. And thanks to your mom, your mother was worried that I was going to starve to death, and put a beautiful charcuterie board together for the group in here, and it was stunning. It was just stunning. And the whipped cream and the strawberries and the it was lovely. You said, you know, high tolerance, but, you know, it's easier when you're eating strawberries and whipped cream.
Well, I'm going to have to hold out for bagels or something here in the morning.
Remember when you used to do the shows and they fed you?
We used to do the media project and we would tape it at 8:30 and we would get a bagel in the morning and that disappeared. And as a board member, I figured we were just saving money.
Yes, it's a cost-cutting effort. Nick mentioned this and I just want to remind you. So we're trying to fill the lockbox. We're trying to get the lockbox filled. And it's fund drive time. It's also election time. And we are very cognizant of the fact that those two are smushing together. And we want to try to make as much money as we possibly can. So we in no way keep you from, I mean, we wouldn't, but no way keep you from hearing all of the programs and things that you normally hear during that time leading up to the momentous election day. So what we're going to do, we're opening up the lockbox a little bit earlier, and that's why we had the event on Tuesday night. So on Thursday, next Thursday, a week from today, we will be doing a DEI panel, and this is going to be live at the Linda, and you can be a member of our audience, and all the money that we make on this goes into the lockbox. I will tell you that this was an event that was scheduled for earlier. It was scheduled for that week where former President Trump got shot and then Joe Biden dropped out, and we just thought, okay, we have to put this off until after so we can cover everything we have to cover. So that's what we did. We have a great panel. Let me tell you who's going to be on the show. Nick Rangel, of course, Judy Patrick, Alfredo Medina Jr., who is Vice President for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at Bennington College, also a Title IX coordinator there. He formerly was with the State University of New York at Albany. Jay Holly, who is Director of DEI and Belonging at Together for Youth. Vera Carius-Kelly, Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics. And Angela Alozi, who is Director of Energy and Climate Equity at NYSERDA. So a really great group of individuals who will be together on the 19th, 1 week from today. If you would like to join us, it's a $75 pledge to attend. All you got to do is go to WAMC.org and go to the drop-down menu, and you can get as many tickets as you want for $75 each. Then just join us. It's a will call event. Your name will be at the door. Come in and join us. We would like to fill the place, and we certainly hope that we will. This is a huge issue. It's a very complex issue. We have a great panel, and we do hope that you join us. Also, it's an opportunity to really help us with the lockbox, and we need to do that. And people say all the time, so when's your next event? Well, this is it. It's our next live event at the Linda. 8:30 is when we will welcome you. 9 o'clock is the show. We'll go to 11, and you can come and go as you please. But that is when it is, and we would love to have you. WAMC.org. Go to the lockdown menu, drop-down menu, not lockdown, no, drop-down menu. Also, you can call us 1-800-323-9262. If you already had tickets and you already signed up for it, those tickets, of course, are good for this event that we're having on Thursday. I'll talk more about that a little bit later, but just to put it into your ear and let you know that that is something that we are working on very hard, and we do hope that you will join us as we not only talk about important issues around this election, but also try to raise money to show this is a radio station that's going to do things like have a two-hour panel on DEI, and where else do you get that? And those things, and to support them is important so that we can keep that type of material on this radio station. With that, it's time to start the show. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we would love to hear from you. So, as mentioned, we all saw most of us, I think, saw the debate, and we probably all have our opinions as to what happened there. But former President Donald Trump said he had a great debate. He has been spinning aggressively his debate performance, suggesting that it was the best ever. His allies privately say otherwise. Former President Donald Trump went into a sales pitch mode immediately after Tuesday night's debate, walking into the spin room to extol his own performance, crowing on Fox News and going on late night posting spree to hype unscientific online polls that he said showed he had crushed Vice President Kamala Harris. "This was my best debate ever," shouty caps. "Especially since it was 3-on-1. Shouty caps. This is a reference to the two ABC News moderators. That, of course, a posting on Truth Social. Mr. Trump was insisting the same things privately to advisors and allies in the hours after the debate, according to three people with direct knowledge who spoke on the condition of anonymity. Mr. Trump appeared jubilant, as if he truly believed that he was telling them what he was telling them. But Mr. Trump's actions after the debate told another story. In the lead up to his debate with President Biden in late June, Mr. Trump's aide suggested that he might want to go into the spin room afterward, but he rejected the idea. And after his triumphant performance that night, he felt no need to enter the spin room, understanding that his victory over the enfeebled president was so comprehensive that he could sit back and watch the press tear Mr. Biden apart. His aggressive spinning on Tuesday night and Wednesday morning appeared to be an unspoken acknowledgement that his performance was suboptimal. This word is being used a lot in regards to the president's debate, former president's debate performance. The day after Mr. Trump's debate with Ms. Harris, his aides and his allies were largely echoing his praise of his performance in public, but privately conceding that the former president had a rough outing in stark contrast to his more controlled appearance against Mr. Biden. An exception was the recent Trump endorser Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Vice President Harris clearly won the debate in terms of her delivery, her polish, her organization, and her preparation, Mr. Kennedy said on Fox News on Wednesday, adding that while Mr. Trump wins on substance, he didn't tell that story. Ira, what do you think?
Well, this is like a grab bag. There's so many places we can go with this. I'll leave the others to talk more about the substance of the debate. And, I mean, clearly, in my view, Harris mopped the floor with him. And the fact that Trump is trying to say otherwise once again shows what I've been talking about for a long time, that the people who think MAGA people are stupid are not the Democrats, but it's the people like Trump who plays them for suckers and has a debate such as the one he just had and then comes out and said, we did great. It's the best one I ever had. I mean, it's just nonsense. What I was particularly interested in, and we may wind up talking about this more on the media show, which is we're going to tape after this, but the way it was moderated, the fact-checking or lack thereof, the follow-ups or lack thereof, I'm really torn about it. One being the fact-checking, where three or four times David Muir broke in and said, no, you say it's this way, but it's that way.
They're not eating dogs in Springfield.
Yeah, and it generally has been favorably received at them having done that. I'm of the mind, although I can be convinced otherwise, that those fact checks in a debate setting should have been offered up by the opponent of the person who said the original error. I mean, it's a part of the debate. If you say tomorrow is Monday, there shouldn't be a moderator saying, no, it's tomorrow is Tuesday. That should be the participant saying it, in my view. So there's that. And then the other thing was I felt, by the way, generally speaking, I thought the moderators did very well, but so I'm picking on them and small stuff. I get disappointed when they ask a question and the participant doesn't answer the question and just goes on and whatever the subject he or she wants to catch up on.
Right.
And I think it, when that occurs, even after having given them the time to say whatever they want, the moderator should say, but you didn't answer my question, and pin them down on that.
David Muir, well, they both were very good at that, I thought, in the sense of they would say, okay, but the subject is Afghanistan. And
yeah.
Okay, you're you're talking not about that. So, but the subject is, and they would try, and I think it was easier to bring Kamala Harris back into the
Well, one of the downsides would have been is if Trump, for example, doesn't answer the question, then goes on and uses his 2 minutes to talk about something else, and then you say you didn't answer my question, then he winds up getting more time than he should get.
Which he did.
He wound up getting about 5 minutes more.
Nick.
I just wanted to say I think Trump is correct. It probably was one of his best debates, right? He did not fly off the handle too often. He did, from some people's perspectives, win, I guess, certain points. Some people were very happy with his answers on things like, actually, some people were happy with his answers on Ukraine, believe it or not. Some people were happy on his answers on the economy. He got, I think, tripped up on what he should have come out stronger on with his voters on immigration, because Harris is quite skilled, it turns out, at goading him into chaos, I guess, but he did do pretty well for a Trump debate, and I guess that says a lot.
Yeah, JP.
Yeah, I obviously think he did poorly, And I don't think he necessarily did well in the first debate with Biden. It's just he was next to Biden, who did so poorly that the focus was not on Trump and his answers. I think it's a real big question as to whether he will debate again. I think his advisors are likely convinced that he is incapable of turning in a debate different than he did the other night. I think Republicans in general, a lot of friends that I talk to who I know are Trump voters, are frustrated, who say, how could he not prosecute a cogent policy argument against Vice President Harris, where there are such big differences in the country on immigration, on the economy, on health care, on abortion, on all these issues. And an example of that is, you know, you're arguing about abortion, and he continues to say, well, they allow abortions after the baby's born. There's people executing babies. And it's just on its face ridiculous, you know, and he does that over and over on every single topic. On immigration, there's a reasonable case to be made that maybe the country should have a different immigration policy than what's been happening over the last 3.5 years, but he can't. He is incapable of prosecuting any of those arguments. I think that we will not know whether there's going to be another debate until about 10 days from today. And that's when the swing state polls will be taken, where they take into account not just the people that watch the debate. Watching the debate is important, but also the 2 to 3 to 4 days after the debate, where we're all on the radio talking about it, everybody's on the TV talking about it, we're reading it, and the debate performances are digested by the American people, and we will see whether there is movement in the swing state polls, where almost all of them, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, North Carolina, you look at Real Clear Politics, they're all within a point and a half in all of those polls. And so I think Vice President Harris is excited to debate again. She didn't come close to making a single mistake. Her closing argument was one of the most well-practiced, well-thought-out, perfectly delivered. People say, oh, she memorized it. Well, yeah, that's the point. You prepare for a debate, you have your closing statement memorized, and you put together a clear thing that you want the American people to view. This is why you're going to vote for me. And so she's excited to debate again. I don't know whether you will get Trump to agree to another one, because he can't do better than what we saw the other night, in my opinion.
Well, he wants, if he were to do another debate, he would want Fox to do it, and he's already denouncing the would-be moderators on Fox. So I think he's laying the groundwork to say, no, I don't want to do it. I can't get a fair break even at Fox. I'm surprised that Harris, I guess Harris is, with justification, really hyped about how well she did, because she does apparently want a second debate. And one of the things Trump said that was accurate is usually the person who loses the first debate wants the second debate. And she doesn't really need another debate, I don't think. It would be risky. She can't do much better than she just did.
Well, I do think she needs more time and more opportunity to show people greater detail on some of the issues she didn't get to talk as much about, and to kind of share a little bit more about who she is as like a human being. I think those are the two things that responses that we've heard from the debate that people want to know who she is. So there is some value in going on stage again and having another debate and taking another opportunity, particularly because Trump did get significantly more time to speak and respond to questions than she did in this debate. And I do think she could get him to, if she poked that bear enough, right? If she kind of dangled like a carrot in front of him. I think he's a little, you know, he's kind of childish, maybe, and and she clearly has the upper hand in that way. And I think there's lots of reasons for why. I think, you know, he is a misogynist, he is narcissistic, and I think it drives him nuts that she is as competitive in this race as he is, where he clearly believes that he is like far superior to like anything Harris could provide to the country. So I think there is some value for her. And also, I think if she plays her cards right, she could get him to do it.
If my memory is right, and I can guarantee you it may not be right, but when the debates were run by the debate commission,
it's a steel trap,
and they had more than one debate planned ahead of time, two and I think occasionally three.
Yes.
Each of the debates had a theme. So in other words, you'd have a domestic debate, you'd have an international debate, and I don't know what the third one was.
It was like foreign policy, and then.
So the question to consider is if they were to have another debate. And only one other, because it doesn't seem likely. If they have a second one, they won't have a third one. Would the second one be similar in the topics to what we just heard? And in that case, what can be gleaned when we've already had that debate? Or is there going to be an onus on the moderators to come up with a whole new bunch of subjects, which may or may not be a good idea? But the whole structure has fallen apart because Trump didn't want to take part with the commission.
With a commission on debates and which has overseen debates for decades. It will be interesting to see exactly if they come up with anything. We are also, we should mention that there is going to be a vice presidential debate, and that is in October. It's not that far away. It's going to be between Tim Walz and J.D. Vance. And in my opinion, like, they've never meant a whole lot. I mean, they're important, but they're more of sideshow than the two candidates going after each other. Sometimes they can have some good viral moments. The Fly. But
Dan Quayle moment.
That's the Dan Quayle moment. Yeah. But still, you know, how much are they is gonna come out of that? And for either campaign, is it going to propel people to change their mind if their mind has not already been made up?
Yeah, the vice presidential debate, I think you will see both J.D. Vance and Tim Walz are both polished politicians who will both turn in, I think, reasonably good debate performances. Hard to imagine one or the other really dominating. But going back to another presidential debate, it's interesting you brought. I was also thinking, Ira, about the Presidential Debate Commission and how those debates, some were standing up in the round and questions asked by the audience members. You saw, the candidates, just them walking around the stage was certainly stagecraft and stuff that voters took into account as they watched them interact with each other and shake hands and take on the different topics. And it's I'm surprised that any debates get agreed to, because the campaigns used to have no input. The debate commission would say, here are the three debates, here are the dates, here are the locations, here are the topics. They would they would dictate it to the campaigns. The campaigns would have no input as to what and having the Harris campaign and the Trump campaign negotiate another debate, I think it's hard to believe it gets pulled off, even though I think Harris, even though she won that first debate, she wants another one. These swing state polls, I think that you will see her gain in the swing state polls in 10 days, but I don't think it's going to be in 10 days we're all going to think it's a wipeout.
It's right.
She has work to do to win. And I think that the debate better, she would rather debate Trump than do an interview with a mainstream media outlet, because it's going to be a better venue for her. You know, she's going to perform better against Trump than she would against George Stephanopoulos or a reporter,
which I still don't quite understand. I don't understand the reluctance of doing that, of doing a sit down major interview, whether it be 60 Minutes or Christiane Amanpour or somebody, and doing because she certainly showed she's great in that setting. Just do the same. It's the same skill set. You know what you want to say, and you do it. I don't understand. I thought the debate, or excuse me, the interview that they did on ABC, or it was CNN with Dana Bash, right? Where the two of them were together, it was fine. but it wasn't. I don't know what they necessarily gained out of it, and I do think doing it together was probably a mistake.
Well, I think I'm confident that she will do any number of interviews. 60 Minutes is an obvious one, but I'm sure she will. A, because she must, and B, because I think she's up to it. I believe that she very wisely took the path that she took when Biden dropped out and ramped up her own candidacy and did all the right things and was not encumbered by a major interview. And I'm certain that she will have them. The public is going to demand it, and she will adhere to it.
JP?
I imagine she will do more interviews, although she walks a delicate rope in terms of how she has evolved on some key issues, and that is obviously what the journalists are going to focus on. 4 years ago, you were for this fracking and et cetera, you're against fracking, whatever. All, you know, the position she took during the 2020 nomination when she was trying to run to the left of Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, and those positions, she's obviously evolved. Now, she knows that every vote that she needs to win is a middle-of-the-road voter who is thinking in their mind that they may vote for Donald Trump or they may vote for Kamala Harris. There are those people out there, and those are the people that are going to determine the election. And so they have to think very carefully what interviews she does with what outlets and how she's going to continue to answer those questions. Where the journalists are going to prosecute the case against her better than Trump. Trump did a very poor job prosecuting the case against Kamala Harris the other night. If she's across from Christiane Amanpour or George Stephanopoulos, she could get into a little bit of a situation where she's not perfectly on message.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's a lot to – well, so I've said all along I think it was a smart move for her to avoid interviews while she developed her platform, redefined who she is as a candidate, and distanced herself from Biden so that she could have kind of her own race. I thought that was clever, and I said that the other night. But going forward, being open to interviews, she has this risk of the so-called undecided voters, which, you know, some people are not sure exist, or the people who she could galvanize and actually get out to vote. And those, the people who are going to stay home, unless they're really enthusiastic, are going to come out to vote on a more progressive issues. And the people that are considered moderate or are swing votes are coming, she would have to appeal to them on a more moderate level. And those things are really in conflict with each other, and I think it makes it really difficult for her to have very specific responses to very complicated issues.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We have a lot of letters, too. We'll get to those. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday morning, 44 minutes past the hour, 45 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock. And we welcome you if you are just joining us. We have a lot of letters. We've been talking about the debate fallout, and the possibility of a second debate, which has been called for by Kamala Harris. And apparently, the Trump folks are thinking about it, working out some of the logistics. But the chances, you know, we don't know what the chances are, ultimately, if it will happen or not. We have a lot of letters, so let me get to some of those. Stu writes, "Dear panel, I'd be interested in hearing how many minutes each candidate actually spoke. It seemed that the quote-unquote Pinocchio got much more time to answer than did Harris. The breakdown is as follows. Trump spoke for approximately 42 minutes and 52 seconds, while Harris spoke for 37 minutes and 36 seconds. Trump used about 12 minutes and 54 seconds of his total speaking time to attack Harris, while the vice president dedicated 17 minutes and 25 seconds to criticizing her opponent And I know, wouldn't you love that job of keeping track? So, but yes, it was, as you predicted, Stu, there was more Trump time. Paul writes, Trump did not do well at all. He was sullen or out of control, as always, and he offered no policy and notably failed when he was asked to explain his health care plan. He said he had one in the works, baloney, cop-out, and Harris did offer policy as well as civility. Her comments on financial support in various areas was substantive.
That health care stuff was just hilarious. The man had a promising health care plan every 2 weeks. And we're working on it, and we're this, and now here we are 4 years later from his last term, and they're still working on the concept of a plan.
Well, and also when one of your key debate points is that you were in the Oval Office for 3.5 years right. as vice president,
yeah,
and what have you been doing? Right. So there is that. Dave says your guest is wrong. It is not a debate when one person is constantly lying about what they did, what they will do, and what the other person is or does. You can't argue rationally with an irrational person. I don't know which of you
probably me saying that they shouldn't have a fact checked, because it's up to the opponents to weed their way through their own statements. But I'm not sure. I can go both ways, or as they used to say in the beer commercials, I feel strongly both ways.
I will say that the live fact-checking, I think, sort of highlighted or brought forward the notion that Trump failed or lost the debate in real time, because he would say something and the fact-checker would say out loud to everyone watching, that's not true. And it's an immediate loss, right?
Right.
In real life, right? And I think that has a real impact on what the debate is and what the point of the debate is and who is debating.
None of this is funny because it's so serious, but, and yet, a little chuckle. But, for example, about the eating of pets, and David Muir says, well, no one in Springfield, there haven't been any reports. That is not the case. And Trump's response is, well, I saw it on television. Okay.
But David even went further. He said, I called the city. So, like, David interjected himself into that debate right in that moment and debated with Trump about the validity of the statement.
So, do you think that's appropriate? What
Ira is saying is that should have been Harris. Harris could have gotten that point. And two, that point is taken by the moderators, which isn't really the role of moderators.
If David Muir was sitting down doing a one-on-one with either of the candidates, that would be an appropriate thing for a reporter to do, is point out an error when they make a statement.
But I thought sort of the aghast face that she had sort of told it all. And if you go and you take, again, if she took the bait, and then you're arguing over something that's just ridiculous, as opposed to
on the dogs and cats,
right? Yeah. And saving your time on something that you can actually, a point that is could legitimately be made. When Lindsay Davis did about the executing of babies at 9 months, and Lindsay Davis, I mean, that was a flat out declarative, that doesn't happen. And I think that was even more potent, because it was just, okay, this is it. I mean, that just doesn't happen.
Right.
And he didn't respond to that. He just stopped. So there is that. Let's go to Jeff, who says, the bear should absolutely be poked, prodded, and taunted in any way possible. Trump could stand it, and neither could his base. I feel the pressure he would feel will be too much for him to bear, so poke the bear and... let's all watch the show. I mean, that is sort of that is an argument that I think has been around since 2016. If you let him go long enough, he'll, you know, find enough rope. However, 9 years later, Russ says, the thing that most impresses me about the debate is the apparent lack of effect it had on Trump supporters. They continue to believe that they will be better off with Trump in office. We did talk about this at some point.
There was an interesting interview. I can't recall if it was in the Times or if it was a broadcast interview, but they talked to somebody who I would describe as a very nice, not an unintelligent woman who was wrestling about who she should vote for. And she described herself, as, in my words, as disgusted by what Trump, all of the Trump negatives. But she has found that the economy is so bad that if Trump is going to bring it back to the way it was when he was there, then she'd have to reluctantly vote for him. And I think there's a lot of that out there. There are a lot of people who have fallen into the cult and who they're taking advantage of. But there is a sizable number of people who have a similar concern about the economy.
Lynn writes, I agree that the presidential debates are more important and significant. The vice presidential candidate debate could be significant given the ever-present possibility that the individual could become the nation's president. It is unlikely this will be anyone's deciding factor, but it creates some record and expectations for the future to which they might be held should they rise to power. That from Lynn.
I do think the vice presidential debates will be super interesting because, for one thing, J.D. Vance is relatively inexperienced at the national level, and there's a lot of speculation about his personality and, you know, whether or not he can have just kind of a normal conversation with people. And I see this on like late night TV, like, oh, he's so awkward. He can't order donuts, whatever. But I don't know that will arrive on a stage where he has the opportunity to have sort of a really controlled environment. I think it's also interesting because, as we've been saying all this time, if Joe Biden were unable to continue being the president, Harris would have been the president, and Trump is, you know, not a young man. And so JD really does have this proximity, the exact same argument about why the vice president was important under Biden that we should be having about why is the vice president important under a Trump presidency. He was echoing the, like, people eating their neighbor's dog's comments. Like, he's got something there that I'm, like, super curious about. And I feel like Walz is becoming, like, the national sweetheart. Like, people just love Walz. And I want to see that show. I want to watch that. And I've never wanted to watch it.
Normality is attractive sometimes. Yeah.
Well, it's more than normality, right? Like after the debate, the camera went to Tim Walz and he was like just exuberant. I mean, he was so, you know, supportive and proud to be the nominee with Harris. And you just really don't see that kind of, I'm going to say the word, joy, right? I mean, it's kind of adorable, and they couldn't be two different kind of human people.
They're also two unknowns. We haven't seen Tim Walz really in action. We haven't seen J.D. Vance really in action, except for us political junkies who have seen clips from past debates. But we've all seen the Trump debate show a number of times, and I think that's part of why he's viewed to have done so poorly the other night, is it's the same old stuff that we've seen over and over and over again. We have seen Kamala Harris in a national debate before, and she acquitted herself very well, much like she did against Mike Pence 4 years ago. But Walz and J.D. Vance are two new fighters on the scene, first time having 50 million people watch them in a debate with high stakes. It will be great television viewing. I imagine, though, that they can both remember their lines, stick to the script. We will not see, I don't think, a big win for either one. I think it'll likely be a draw.
And J.D. Vance is smooth. I mean, he's the crazy doesn't sound as crazy, even though it is crazy.
Right. I was about to go there. I think his politics are actually really pretty extreme.
And, oh, yeah.
And I'm not sure how much he can hedge or soften or hide the extreme in a debate context. And I'm not sure how well can Tim Walz draw it out of him either.
Well, and talk about flip-flopping. I mean, he's been all over the place on so many issues. And you know, Exhibit A is his book. So we'll start there. We were talking earlier, JP, about as you watch the debate again and you sort of see things that you didn't see or didn't notice or even in the coverage sort of got lost. But that all of a sudden that just like Trump practically screaming about how much Biden hates Harris was an odd moment. He hates her. He despises her. He can't stand her. It was a weird moment, that I had sort of forgotten about with all of the other weird moments that were going on.
What'd you think of the handshake?
I mean, I thought it was brilliant. I thought it was great. It was, you know, I have felt often like Trump when people come to shake your hand that, you know, you want to run for the green room. But I thought it was obviously it would be nice in a civil society and debate if two candidates came out, shook hands and then went off and did their thing. But the fact that she did it and the thing I loved about it was. Hi, I'm Kamala Harris.
Yeah, she introduced herself.
Yeah, that's great.
Do we think that she did that because there's the first time they met, or because she wanted to pronounce her name right for him?
Both. Yeah, I think. But either way, it's great because he never used her name. He never said her
he
name
never
in the
looked
entire
at
debate.
Her either.
Didn't look at her, and he didn't say her name.
And yesterday in Lower Manhattan at the memorial. They shook hands, brokered, it appears, by Bloomberg.
That's right.
But if you can, I was trying to watch that carefully, and she mouthed the words thank you when she shook Trump's hand, and I couldn't imagine, still don't know what she could possibly have been saying thank you to him for.
I actually saw something on that, which they thought she was reacting actually to Bloomberg for thank you for.
Oh, to him,
yeah,
not her.
Yeah, but I don't know.
I just thought it was amazing. It was such a power move. We talked about it earlier, like, should she just go to her podium? Should she completely ignore him? But this is how I've heard it described. She walked across the stage. She chased after him and made him shake her hand. And then he tried to do his, you know, weird, like, pull-in power thing, and she just let go and walked away. It was beautiful, absolutely glorious. And she's a class act. I mean, you know, adults should be able to shake hands and say hello before combat, right? And the fact that he can't is so petulant, but also just such a great image.
Go ahead.
I thought it was a power move. It was a rehearsed, smart power move, and it took him off his game immediately. He was not expecting a handshake. He was going to slink to the podium and not look at her, and it. I believe intimidated him from the get-go.
Only Ira will probably get this reference, but it was the GE handshake.
GE in the lobby with a fruit basket.
Look it up.
It's too confusing to explain.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we will return with Ira Fussell, J.P. Miller, and Nick Rangel. First News with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Let's see. We are looking. The music is Rosalie playing the Woods' Festival at Arrowwood Farms in Accord, excuse me. Thank you, Ira.
Yeah, very productive of our Ulster County towns.
Correct pronunciation again. Accord.
Accord. Okay. Yeah, and it's not a town, but it's
after all these years, I should know that. But anyway, 9/21, the 21st of September. All right. You can see the playlist, wamc.org/roundtable. Quick reminder that we have a DEI panel, and we are inviting you to be in our audience for this. It's going to be a great event, I think. It's a very important topic, and one that we have assembled a great group of individuals to discuss it. And we welcome you. For a pledge of $75, you can attend per ticket. And this is a fundraiser for the October Lockbox, to put money into the lockbox and to make it easier and to try to get the fund drive finished as soon as possible so we have as much time as we need to talk about these important issues leading up to Election Day. We would love to have you join us. If you've never been to one of our live panels, they're a lot of fun. We have a really, really good time. And Nick's mom comes. I don't know if she's going to be at this one or not.
I'm sure she will.
Yes, it's
my sister
great.
Comes too.
Yes, it's very nice.
They really are very nice.
They're very nice. And have you ever been?
Little breakfast spreads.
Have you ever been? You've been a part of one, haven't you?
I have. They're awesome.
Yeah, and the thing that always shocks me about them, always, is I say to people at the beginning, how many of you have ever attended one of these before, and 75% of the hands go up. And I just figure it's the same, you know, people that come every time, but it's not.
Right.
And that's very, very cool. Yeah. And so they're a lot of fun. We have a great time. Obviously, we're talking about a serious topic, but the questions will come from the audience, and we would love for you to be in that audience. All you have to do is go to WAMC.org, WAMC.org. It is in the drop-down menu when you make your pledge. Also, you can, in addition to that, you can call 1-800-323-9262. Actually, I said in addition, it's or. So you would either go to you'd go to the website, or you would call 1-800. You don't have to do both. That's
you
overdoing
could,
it.
But yeah. You don't need to.
No need to. Unless you need, like, support. 1-800-323-9262, 1-800-323-WAMC. That is a week from today, Thursday the 19th, and we'll start off around 8:30 or so, and the show will go from 9 to 11, and we would love to have you in the audience with us for this broadcast that will be going live at the Linda on Central Avenue in Albany. All right. Let's go back to the show at hand, and we'll move on to other subjects because we have quite a few, a lot of political stuff here. But I would like to talk about, I don't think, as we discuss the polls that have come out after the debate, of what I think one of the questions that we had yesterday was, does this matter? So I thought what we would do is just take a look at the polls that have come out after the debate, and these are quick polls, and then will this have any real push one way or the other? Vice President Kamala Harris turned in one of the more resounding debate performances in recent decades on Tuesday night, to the point where Donald Trump's allies have struggled to locate a silver lining. This from the Washington Post. Precisely how much the debate could impact the race is an open question. As my colleague Dan Balls notes, this is from Aaron Blake of the Washington Post. So as Balls notes, we're a very polarized country, and we don't generally see big and sudden shifts in polls anymore, but small margins can matter greatly in our increasingly tight elections, and Harris clearly helped her cause. So two instant polls that have come out. The CNN poll showed Harris winning the debate 63% to 37% among debate watchers, while the YouGov poll showed her winning 54% to 31% among registered voters who watched at least some of the debate, with 14% unsure. Trump has cited his own improbably wide margins in some unscientific online polls, posting a series of them on Truth Social, but those polls don't reflect the actual electorate. Notably, those margins are close to the ones Trump racked up after President Joe Biden's disastrous debate performance on June 27th, a performance that ultimately led him to drop out of the 2024 race. Back then, the CNN poll showed Trump winning the debate 67-33%, while the YouGov poll showed Trump winning 43-22%. And that would leave a lot of other people who just didn't know what to make of that debate, which I think was probably the case for many of us trying to figure it out. Harris's performance also ranks up there with more decisive wins in recent history, according to CNN's numbers, though it's worth noting that a strong debate doesn't necessarily translate into a White House victory. So important to note. With that said, how do we look at this, JP, and say, okay, and I know you talked about this a little bit, I just want to expand on it, of where we take these numbers and say, okay, what is it going to do in a Pennsylvania, in a Georgia, where it's one and a half points?
Yeah, what I would say is it's not just the people that watch the debate, but the coverage after the debate. And you look at Pennsylvania right now, according to Real Clear Politics and Real Clear Polling, which what I love to look at, which is an average of all the polls. Pennsylvania even, Wisconsin, Harris plus 2, Arizona, Trump plus 1.5, Georgia even, Michigan, Harris plus 1, Nevada even, North Carolina even. So there is no swing state where someone has more than a 2 percentage point lead. I would also encourage listeners to remember that in 2020 and 2016, Trump outperformed on Election Day, outperformed the polls. So if you look at polls now and you say that these polls are even and you're trying to predict, I'd predict that Trump would win those states where things are even. Harris, to win, in my view, has to have a 3-4% lead in those swing state polls for her to feel confident like she has a chance of winning. I think it's impossible for her to put in such a commanding debate performance and not have those states move in her direction. I think all of the states will swing in her direction. The question is, does she get a 1 percentage bump, a 2 percentage bump, or a 3 percentage bump? A 3 percentage bump doesn't sound like much. That's huge. That's 6% of the people flipping from Trump to Harris.
You know, it could be 50,000 people who are going to decide it.
Yes.
I want to get to Nick. One paragraph in this article I thought was interesting, though, and how scientific this is in these quick polls, I don't know. But favorable opinions of Harris also increased by 6 points among debate watchers from 39% before the debate to 45%. That's the biggest image gain for a candidate in the 7 times that CNN has asked that question before and after a presidential debate took place since 2008. That seems to speak volumes too, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm actually really curious about these, like, I don't know, it's a weird way to phrase this, but they're called closet voters. No one should be in a closet, but they're being called closet voters. People who are kind of secretly planning to vote for Harris, who, because of the nature of their local politics or their household politics, aren't very vocal. They don't talk about how they're going to vote. Maybe their spouses are split or something along those nature. And there's a lot of chatter about those people being underrepresented in the polls because they're not participating and they're kind of a great unknown. We don't know how many or how often that is happening, but it does seem that they would be pretty prevalent in these swing states where people really are kind of in a purple space. And I'm wondering what you think about that.
Well, I mean, it flips the script from 2016 where Trump's victory was
closet result, Trump voters,
right who would not come out and say, I'm going to vote for this guy who said that, you know, there's going to be a Muslim ban and so forth.
Called Hispanics bad hombres.
Right.
I mean, he said many outlandish things and people were embarrassed.
That was, you know, 9 years ago and that was new to us. And so that was a group that, yes, who were not coming out and saying we're going to vote for Trump necessarily when they were polled. Whether that script has been flipped, I don't know.
I keep thinking, listening to the numbers that JP was citing, particularly the average, Real Clear Politics average, is that if it's in fact as close as it appears to be via the polls, that the day after Election Day, we are not going to know who the new president is, and we may not know for weeks. It's hard to imagine Trump conceding. He doesn't do that.
Nope.
And if it's a
he
real,
still hasn't done it. It's
impossible to imagine.
Yeah, I mean, think of all the ways that he will drag this out if, in fact, it does not go his way. And even if it goes the other way, if Harris should win by more than a close race, he will complain about it. There's no way that could happen without being rigged because the polls were closer than this. Being the glass half empty guy that I am, I just worry a lot about what's going to happen the day after and the weeks after Election Day. And that doesn't even take into consideration another version of January 6th coming down the road.
To JP's point, in looking at Real Clear Politics and this average of the polls, in battleground states, did I just lose this? Did this just change on me? I'm sorry. Yeah, there we go. In the battleground states, currently Trump has 47.7%, and this is an average of the polls, and Harris has 47.9%, so that's 0.2%. I mean, so when you're talking,
the point I just wanted to make
in agreeing with you is that when you look at 1.2, 1.23 percentage point difference compared to 0.2, that's huge if it is possible to get that in the remaining weeks of the race.
And she, after the convention, she had a phenomenal convention. She came out, she popped in the polls in the swing states in the days after, but leading up to the debate, they have evened out. And we'll see whether she gets another pop after the debate. I have to imagine she can. But if you're Vice President Harris, you want to keep that momentum. You want another debate. You want another two debates, because they're such momentum generators. There's no other thing like them in presidential politics outside of a scandal on a Trump scandal or a Harris scandal.
I mean, he's had all the scandals. There is no scandal that Trump cannot and would not spin in his favor, right? I think the only person at risk of a scandal is Harris, and only because she's a woman of color and she's not Trump, who seems to somehow get away with his many, many scandals.
Well, he's already tried the Willie Brown, she's sleeping his way to the top, and that seems to have had no momentum at all. So I don't know what it's hard to imagine what negatives that he can pull out of his hat in the days before the election, if in fact it still looks close. But it's pretty scary to think what he might come up with, because he obviously has no compunction about lying and inventing stuff out of whole cloth.
Well, I mean, we'd mentioned this the other day. So the Times has that podcast, you know, running up to the election, and they interviewed these swing voters, and one of those voters basically described the only thing he knew about Harris was this, you know, sleeping their way to the top narrative. And when you drill down on that, to me, we're just talking about this like exceptionally misogynistic person who has a countless extramarital affairs, who is facing criminal repercussions for paying off a woman who he had sex with, and is liable for sexual assault, but the focus is on a man Harris dated 30 years ago as a grown adult when both people were single grown adults in their community, who she just happens to not now be married to. I mean, what are we even talking about? It boggles the mind. And I do appreciate that in the debate, she did kind of denormalize some of that kind of behavior by just calling him out for being for saying these outlandish things and for being so divisive on things that just should not be part of the conversation.
Putin will eat you for lunch.
Yes.
I mean, I know that's not what you're talking about. But I mean, it's just like those moments where she would say something that was like, whoa, okay, that's very powerful.
It was excellent.
Marty says, I don't think Harris has anything to gain by doing media interviews. This election is about 7 swing states with 3% of the voters. I believe Harris needs to concentrate on those states and counties and doing local interviews, which is the plan. But, I mean, the problem with the local interviews is that they're local. They don't go beyond, you know, they don't go beyond and to help shape the message more globally. And that can be from one swing state to another.
I'll be shocked if she doesn't do 60 Minutes. It's just it's got to be. It's a historic stopping point for candidates.
Judy, Patrick, and I already figured this out. It's going to be like the season. I don't know when the season premiere of 60 Minutes is. I can find out, but I assume that'll be the interview, and then the next week, Bob Woodward's book comes out.
Oh, interesting.
So he'll be on Sunday. Then the book will come out Tuesday, and then we'll have like the 2 weeks of stuff prior to that of the leaks from the book. So there's a lot to look forward to, Ira.
I think we're missing, so we're talking about interviews and debate, but one of the things this campaign has been particularly strong on is social media.
Absolutely.
They're on the TikTok, they're doing Instagrams, they're really connecting with voters where voters are watching kind of constantly and nonstop 24/7 right now in a particularly strong way, and I think in a way that's superior and more strategic than the Trump campaign, which is just putting stuff out in an echo chamber on Truth Social to their own followers, right? I think that's where they're going to have sort of the biggest impact, particularly with the celebrity endorsements. We've got Taylor Swift, who's likely to get, you know, I don't know, 500,000 people registered to vote. And being able to connect to that demographic, I think, is one of their strong points.
I thought,
because who watches TV? Like, I don't watch TV.
You have it on while you look at your phone sometimes.
No, I don't.
No, you don't even have it on.
No, I don't. I don't watch TV. Yeah. I don't know. I'm on social media. I read the news. But people don't watch TV. Don't look at me like that, Joe.
No, I don't know.
I also don't watch TV unless there's a presidential debate on.
Okay.
So I watched the presidential debate because I wanted to see their body language, their positioning. I literally wanted to see that part of the performance. So
I'm just curious, when you say you don't watch television, so if there is so does that mean you're watching streaming instead?
Yes, yes.
Or so you will say Succession, you may watch that, but you would watch it on your phone, or you wouldn't watch it?
No, I didn't love Succession, but I would watch it on streaming. I would watch it on a television on streaming. But when we're saying, you know, are people going to sit down and watch an interview news channel? Like, no.
Yeah.
Not really.
Well, it's the reason I was trying to ascertain is because I find myself now watching, because all of the late night shows, so whether it be
Jon Stewart or
Colbert or Seth Meyers and Closer Look.
What about Jimmy
John
Fallon?
Oliver?
No.
Jimmy Fallon? No.
No.
John Oliver, absolutely. Although I do watch John Oliver. Bill Maher I'll listen to. But they're all podcasted. And I listen to those podcasts. Sometimes they're very visual and it's hard, but I do. That's how I catch up, because
I watch Seth Meyers, is actually the podcast and also The Corrections.
Yes.
Favorite.
Great stuff. But it's a way of sort of grabbing all that, getting all that in that you wouldn't necessarily, but I still watch television.
Well, as Chance the Gardener said in Being There, I like to watch. If you don't get the reference, go to the GE reference.
Yeah, that's right. It's,
but, you know, watching it on streaming is watching TV. It's just, it's not the, although you can get it on computer and on podcast, if you watch Succession, say, and what you watch it on streaming, you're still watching TV. It's just how you're getting it delivered.
Right.
I think, though, like when we're suggesting that Harris should do an interviews, and they should, and she should sit down with journalists. Frankly, that event would happen, and then I would watch the recaps of the thing, right? Like, or
well,
listen. I would listen to it,
right?
Right. I'm unlikely to pull up last week's interview on 60 Minutes and watch it tonight when I finally have time to sit down and watch my TV show, because by then it's kind of old. I've already heard all the hot takes. The responses have already happened. And the social media has kind of fed me the detail of it that so like the social media thinks I need to know. I'm using this as an example.
No, I understand.
Because I think the campaign is actually better suited spending its time and energy on the first hit on the TikTok and the TikToks and the Instagrams and the Facebook messages and
because they have a longer life.
They have a longer life. They get reshared.
Right.
You're sharing it with your peers. You know, my network is bigger than just your network. Then when we combine our networks, those networks have an amplifying effect. And I think that that's a really clever way to use social media to get that message out.
There are though in those swing states, there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of voters who watch 60 Minutes. Who might not see the hot takes the way you and I consume our news, and you can reach those voters. Now, I'm not advocating that she go on 60 Minutes, but because I think they have the potential to be tougher on her than the Trump, than the Trump debate would be, but. I think if you're running for president, you have to do all of the above. You have to do social media. You have to do traditional media, 60 Minutes. You have to go in and talk to the editorial boards. You have to do an all of the above approach, especially the local media in those swing states.
I would just suggest that the people who are always watching 60 Minutes, the traditional media consumers, are less likely to be swing voters, moderate voters, but not swing voters.
All right, we'll go to Mr. TikTok, Ira Fussfeld, here when we come back, get his view on this. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
Help me, darling, I can't seem to back down on it. I can't seem to feel what's real anymore.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. About 10 minutes left with our panel of Ira Fussfeld, J.P. Miller, and Nick Rangel. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We touched on this, but what does Taylor Swift's endorsement, what could that mean for Kamala Harris? I asked this question for two reasons, but the main one being the fact that I thought the way that it was done was, in a marketing sense, brilliant. It was right after the debate. It was a very, I mentioned this yesterday, a very well thought out, cogent, it wasn't This was something that was very thoughtful, and it wasn't just, hey, I like Kamala Harris, I'm going to vote for her, and I hope you do too. This was a real thoughtful, in-depth, reasoned argument as to why this person who has 250 million followers and also is... I know I'm going to hear about this, but I apologize. But like Beatles-like fan base and hysteria. And not that it will last as long as that, but it's there now. And what that could mean for, and Nick, you touched on this, which I think is probably the most important aspect of this, of getting, how many people did you mention? Half a million people to, and we would assume younger people, to vote.
Yeah. I think there's been a lot of analysis about the importance or the impact that celebrity endorsements can have on elections. I think the timing was particularly great, right? She had the VMA awards and did extremely well, and there's a lot of attention on Taylor. It's football season has started. I think there's lots of things, right? Not to be silly, but there's been some concern that young voters are not enthusiastic about voting right now. They're very frustrated with the war in Gaza. They are very frustrated with the way that protesters were treated on college campuses. They're very frustrated with Biden's inability to connect with young voters. I think, you know, even in the debate, Trump mentioned that the promise of college debt forgiveness has fallen short from what earlier supporters had hoped for, and really it's young voters who are getting hit the hardest with inflation and rising costs and the inability to find affordable housing, and just I think that particular voting bloc is just very frustrated, and a celebrity like Taylor Swift does help at least bring maybe some levity to the party, but also some hope and some optimism in a way that I think the Democrats really need in order to get people to make a plan to go and vote. It also helps with voter registration when you have celebrities pushing that message out to their viewers and sending a link. This is how you vote. This is how you register. This is how you register. This is how you register. And you just like nail that down over and over and over again. It's just a very successful, I think, or a very promising tactic or strategy. Yeah.
JP?
I think that I thought it was interesting and remarkable and well timed. And I agree with what you said is, you know, I hadn't thought about a lot of that. I do think it's remarkable in that I imagine that she comes from kind of a, or she's in right now, maybe a mixed relationship in terms of political persuasion and with who she's paired up with. And I think that Mahomes's wife, Brittany Mahomes, just endorsed Trump. And so there's a lot to be made for, a lot of speculation about Taylor and Brittany not sitting next to each other at the most recent game, that maybe there's a rift right over politics. And she does touch upon she's not just the biggest pop star in the world by far. She also is very much a part of the NFL, which I would imagine is a Trump skewing audience and group at those games among the athletes and the fans. But I thought it was great. I thought how she signed it single cat lady or childless cat lady was brilliant. And a lot of celebrities, I don't think, matter. She's one that she's the biggest pop star on the planet, which is a big deal.
Yeah, I was going to agree with that last piece. I don't ordinarily put a lot of stock nor weight to celebrity endorsements, but I think this one is different. It's unique. The following that she has is so significant and seemingly so loyal, literally traveling around the world to see her perform, that I could see a large number of people who may not have been registered registering and voting for Harris. The proof will be in the pudding, obviously, but I think this is a big one.
Well, also just the idea of her bringing AI into it and seeing herself saying in her post, I saw something where I was endorsing Donald Trump that wasn't true, and then I realized that it was my obligation to say what I'm actually doing. And I just thought that was a really good argument.
I really appreciate the the embrace and redirection of the childless cat lady theme. And there's a lot of reasons. One is there are so many people diminishing or underestimating the impact of a Taylor Swift endorsement because there is the misconception that it's only very young kids right listening to Taylor Swift, and that is not the fact, right? My age group, I mean, many age groups, all age groups, but especially young adults, middle-aged adults, are not only Taylor Swift listeners, but are raising their kids in Taylor Swift.
Well,
and I think this is like the Beatles.
Escape.
It's like, oh, my parents listened to the Beatles, and then I listened to the Beatles. And that is what's happening with Taylor Swift. And I don't think people have really embraced or understood that, like, you know, it's like when someone says a year and you're like, oh, that was 30 years ago. That's shocking. And that's what in our minds is happening with Taylor, because she has been a pop star, like a mega star, for so long. And she's not that old, but she just came out so strong so young. And I think that's really interesting, because we're underestimating women and girls. And it again goes back to this sort of closet voter, because she is tapping into a group of people who are often ignored and virtually always underestimated.
I took my niece, 7-year-old niece, to see Taylor Swift whenever, however long ago.
What a funkle.
We had so much
fun.
He's
the funkle.
That sounds awesome.
I've seen Taylor Swift twice because of that. It's great. We had so much fun. But she is now 18, and she is still excited by Taylor Swift and by that endorsement. And now I will add that she has had an interest in politics all along. But I do think, I mean, that's to your point. And then there are, I'm not a parent, but in this case, a funcle, that you do also get to have that touchstone, that moment of saying, oh, okay, this is something that's going to resonate with me as well, which is really cool.
Yeah.
She's also not a pop. Some pop stars are constant on the politics all the time.
Right.
She seems a little bit reluctant in a good way that she's speaking out because she feels so strongly, and she's not one of these celebrities that it's all the time, every, you know, all day, every day on the politics, which I think people tune out a little bit.
Well, in concern that people will be tuning out of this program, we're going to wrap it up, and we will move on. But my thanks to everyone for being with us and for being a part of the discussion this morning. Ira Fussfeld, Nick Rangel, J.P. Miller, you're all wonderful.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you very much. Ira, go off and make great radio
again. Make a project.
Yeah, that's right. Make a media project. We'll be back right after this.